like.
We can't have coffee, can we?
So should we continue?
Yeah.
This is actually a bit too low for me. I'm having to. If I can just
lean forward.
Stretch it up a bit more. Yeah. So I Googled you.
Okay. Well, that's always. It makes no sense, by the way. It's not representative of me at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I would say that.
Do you want to present? Represent yourself.
My day job, and I suppose it sort of infiltrates the rest of my life, is to make materials. I'm very much a person who's about stuff. And I care about, I don't know, physical things. So that the thing about the internet and Google is that it kind of, in a sense, it's quite hard to represent stuff on that.
Yeah.
I mean, you can do it with words, but actually that isn't the same, actually, as touching something as, you know.
Yeah, because it was funny because I looked at this section, this thing on the Tate Modern website where you were all showing materials that were related to the paintings, and but it was funny to be watching it at such a distance on a small screen. You know, it was so I was experiencing it so non-materially. Really.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, it doesn't really work that at all. That almost bears no resemblance to the actual thing that we were trying to do, which is that you have totally. I mean, for instance, we're having a conversation now in this kind of physical space, but if you change this physical space or a lot of things about it, we'd have a completely different conversation. I mean, the fact that this is a imitation leather sofa is annoying to me.
Oh, really?
And
but then, if you're making materials, do you know they're not artificial?
No, but I just feel like I didn't want to sit on an imitation leather sofa at this point. It's kind of hot, you know what I mean, and it's not good material for that. Lights.
So what are your top five favorite materials?
Well, that's impossible to say, isn't it? Because it's not as if I think that all materials are essentially equal. I like to say that I'm a socialist of materials, but that, you know, like all of us, you know, we have our moments where we're brilliant, we shine, and so that's the same for materials. Like, for instance, plastic and polystyrene. I mean, there's not that many fans of polystyrene. You know, you get this cup, you must get it all the time on film shoots and things like that, right? I mean, cups of tea.
It used to be the thing that in Soho you would go and have a cappuccino in a polystyrene cup, and it had a very particular sensory experience, which now is a memory of a certain time, a certain decade. Now it's like this paper, the cardboard.
Yeah, it's changed.
It's a little bit, I don't know, it makes the tea taste funny. The milk does something with the cardboard, I think.
Yeah, actually, we're doing an experiment at the moment about where the sense of taste of tea comes from, and how the glass or the cup affects your taste, and what does it matter what material you drink things out of, and how does that physically affect the actual sensation of taste? But also, I mean, it's all wrapped up in the cultural enclosure of that act as well, which you can't separate.
Yeah.
But I mean, without polystyrene, I mean, so the polystyrene cups, you know, it's actually, as you say, it's retreating from the world in that role. I mean, every time a new material comes into the world, people want to use it for everything. You know, they think they get really excited, you know, like when plastics first arrived in the 1940s and 50s, they had these adverts of a whole house which was completely plastic. And Hoovers were not needed anymore. You had these pictures of people spraying their house with water to clean it. They're like, great, just once a day, you just turn the tap on and you just like watering the garden and you just clean your house. And I love all that. I love that huge enthusiasm that comes out of a new material. And with polystyrene, the same thing. You know, we built everything out of polystyrene, cups and plates and all those horrible takeaways that you get in those kind of clamshell things, and it all looks congealed. But on the face of it, it's a good material for that. It's light. It doesn't conduct heat very well. So you can have really hot things, and you know they'll keep the heat for a long time, and they won't burn you.
And what about in terms of all this stuff and material, and then kind of the landfill, the end of end of the road for materials? Does that affect your work in materials?
Yeah, I mean it's in some senses
things that don't dissolve, that don't go away, that don't.
I think I'm sort of I am not so worried about landfill. I must be one of the few people who's not worried about landfill. I just think that's a treasure trove for the future.
Right.
It's just a piggy bank. Yeah. We're just storing stuff for future generations. They're going to find it really useful.
Right.
We don't quite know how they're going to find it useful yet, but just like someone's given us oil and coal, well, not someone, but, you know, the world has, and we're finding it fantastically wonderful stuff. We're making something for the future, and you know, I think people are too pessimistic about those things.
It's certainly the case that when you see, you know, even an old mobile phone, from the, you know, you always have this, oh my God, isn't it amazing? Do you remember where? You know, there's always this kind of childlike fascination with the lost materials that are then become, you know, then they unlock memory. I mean, that in fact, it's physicality that holds our memory, really.
That's so true, isn't it? I mean, I think that there's a sense in which, this, well, especially smell. Mm. I mean, very much smell and touch and the physical sight of things and picking things up evokes memories that I think that it's hard to get even just from a photograph, which actually it seems a much more accurate representation of that moment. But I can look at old photographs of me and, you know, people and friends in the past and family, and I find it much. I find there's a maybe that is just me, but I find it not. I find it like a dream. It doesn't seem to be real at all.
But the interesting thing is that talking of memory, which goes back to the earlier conversations in this conversation, is that what I always like this idea that the unconscious knows no time. So. There's no time in our unconscious. We don't really have things allocated across time, that these sensations, memories are always available in the present if you come upon them. And I grew up in the west of Ireland when I was from about 5 to 6.5. And when I went back there, I drove through certain roads and suddenly I had all of these memories that just came I was traveling through the same landscape that I hadn't been to for 20 years.
And actually, I sort of think that's something that digital photography could really have a go at, couldn't it? I mean, because the time is encoded now into the photograph, it could actually artificially age those photographs, you know, automatically, right? Because when you look at old printed photographs, they do have an age about them. They have aged, so they do give you a sign of chronology.
They kind of inhabit time, or time is acted on them.
And physical objects do that, right? There's very few physical objects that are immutable in time. So they give you that sense of that quite secure sense that you've come from somewhere and that there is this sense of a journey. Yeah. As you say, your memory doesn't necessarily do that, which makes it far more confusing. And dreams and that subconscious waking up in the morning, going back to sleep for 5 minutes and having that where you inhabit your 20s again somehow, and it's, you know...
In terms of natural materials or unnatural materials, where's your emphasis?
I don't think there is such a thing as a natural material. That's a cultural concept, which changes over time, actually. And the idea of nature itself has changed over time. So I don't think natural materials make much sense. You can talk about materials that are kind of that grow themselves.
Organic materials.
Well, yeah, I mean... Organic has a particular scent. I mean, so for instance, wood, you know, like wood is one of the, I mean, if you talk about favorite materials, you know, wood is the most versatile material at all. I mean, if you have wood, you can do almost anything. You can make shelter, you know, you can make wonderful furniture. You can tables and chairs and houses you can really live with wood, actually. It takes care of you. And it's an amazingly sophisticated material. It has as much kind of variety and complexity as, you know, any of the kind of... I suppose you might think that wood is just wood, but...
Are you a kind of animist? Do you kind of believe that materials have some kind of innate spirit?
You
can say no.
I might plead guilty to that, but not using that word. It's just that if you look, all right, for instance, what is a material? So I've got bone in me now, right? And this is my skin. That's a material. And I've got it. Now, I am not a material. I'm a living person. But in some senses... And at the moment I die, I'll go from being a living person to something not living, and yet all of this will still be exactly as it was, roughly.
So it'll be in a different state entirely. If I like that line from that Leonard Cohen, the lover of your hand is the hand of your lover is clay.
I don't know, I don't know what that means actually. What does that mean?
It means that you know, it's within time, it's going to change as material.
Oh yeah. Well, all right, that's time thing. But what I mean is, I'm not really getting it at all. I'm just saying that the skin that you've got on you and these bones, if you look at them and you try and work out what is it about them, could you make something like it? Could you make a simulacrum of it?
Could you manufacture it?
Could you manufacture it? And this is what we do all the time in labs. I mean, there's a huge, huge number of people around the world trying to make skin. Because, of course, people lose their skin quite a lot and people then want it back and they have disfigurements. And it's huge, that huge activity. And those, they become also philosophical activities, because once you can make skin outside of the body and once you can artificially make skin and put it back on the body and it becomes you, this differential between the natural you, the real you, and this these other things... somehow it becomes dissolved. I have a friend who was dissecting cadavers in a few weeks ago, and you know, as when you die, all these artificial bits of you, well, the bits that have been introduced, like your hips, I think they're still there. Now, are they part of you? They were in your body for 10 years. Are they you? Are they not you? So when you said, are you do you feel like inanimate materials have a kind of artificial life? I mean, I do, because I mean, if they didn't, then how could they become part of you? How could you have a hip replacement and be a person?
Well, I just thought of it because the way you were describing wood was so loving. Yeah.
Well, I suppose I do feel that about materials. I mean, it's not that I'm singling out wood. I'm just saying that I feel like people look at the world in a very functional way these days. We used to all... interact with the material, make things much more. And so everyone had a relationship with materials, fabrics, wood. People would have lathes, people would have workshops, people would be mending things, people would be using wire, gardening.
Well, survival was so much more connected. I mean, now our survival is all is very managed and sort of mediated. Our sense of survival is mediated and managed and distant in terms of material. You know, like... even at the moment, I'm staying in someone's lent me a house in the countryside where she has an amazing kitchen garden.
That's incredible.
And that's to me the biggest luxury. And incredible to see a patch of earth where there were potatoes and now there's chard.
Or
just the idea that food is really coming from the ground. It's, you know, but to actually be physically pulling it out and cooking it and eating it. And, you know, is quite magical.
It is, yeah.
And it makes you realize how distant even eating is from, in terms of the materials of cooking and all of these engagements with matter.
But I would say that's making this vinyl and making the steel for this microphone is the same magic.
Sure, sure.
I mean, that kitchen garden is as much a piece of technology as this steel is.
Is there some kind of historical proximity or engagement with materials that are pre-modern, as it were, that our history, our transgenerational experience of materials that are, let's call it natural for the time being, or organic, as opposed to the relatively short experience of time with nylon, you know, manufactured, industry-based manufactured materials, is so much shorter that we have a different emotional relationship to one set of materials than to another.
Yeah, probably because of the fabric. I mean, it is a historical context, isn't it? I mean, the Victorians were equally freaked out about steel. I mean, there wasn't really... I mean, there was no steel around, really. I mean, it was, you know, a modern invention. And then suddenly you could mass-produce steel, and suddenly you had the trains and you had the bridges and you had these massive steel ships. And steel ships came along and they got rid of these wonderful wooden ships. And I can imagine that moment. I mean, that moment must have been heartbreaking in a way. And I can't, hand on my heart, say that I think that was a good thing. I mean, when I think of a ship and I see the modern ferries that I get on to go to France, you know, and I think they're more efficient and they're safer and they're kind of and they mean that more people can do that. So that in a sense they've made the world a more equal place. So I mean, steel in a sense and all of these technologies really contribute to social equality, but you know, in some cases I feel that, for want of a different word, progress has led to a loss in our appreciation of equality about the world.
Mm.
We fell out of love with wood at some point, and I don't think we've really got it back. I know there's lots of wooden furniture around, but people actually don't take it seriously. People don't have furniture made for them, really. Well, they could.
Why is that, do you think? That is it to do with economics?
I think people want to live like kings, and everyone wants to be a god in that sense, right? They want to have luxury that everyone else has.
But now, in this kind of, you know, with the sort of eco present future that we live in, increasingly wood that becomes a material that's kind of represents or is a sort of symbol of some kind of proximity to nature, that like IKEA kind of presents itself in this Swiss wood or whatever, from Denmark, Finland, somewhere. But it's this idea of, like, you know, now we you know, wood is I think is a kind of luxury. Purity, nature, all these things become luxuries for us, don't they?
I suppose I feel like no one really has taken it seriously in the West, the kind of climate change thing. I think it's all just cosmetic at the moment.
Right,
I just think, I mean, companies use those words in order to sell more products.
Yeah.
I mean, they want more consumption. I mean, it is ludicrous. I mean,
it's
if you really want...
It's being commodified, the whole thing, in a sense.
Well, yeah, I mean, but we live... I mean,
Are questions of climate change, and you said that landfill was an exciting thing potentially for future generations, but how does climate change affect your work?
Well, I suppose so people would say, look, recycling is the way forward for materials, right? I mean, it's a big materials question. You should recycle everything. And we all have these recycling boxes in our houses, or if we don't, we feel guilty about not having them. And for instance, should you recycle the glass wine bottle that you've drunk the night before? Should you throw it in the landfill? This is a question that everyone faces on a weekly basis, I mean, roughly, right?
Yeah, sure.
So if you throw it in the landfill, it's going to become sand very soon, which is what it started out as. And it won't be next to lots of other sand, because that sand is all collects together on the beaches and places like that. But you know, that is it may not be, it may take 100 or 200 years, but in that sense, I'm not so worried about that bottle.
Mm.
And if you recycle that bottle, well, you put it in the recycling pile, what people don't tell you is a lot of it gets put anyway. The local authorities have an obligation to collect, but they don't have an obligation to recycle. So we assuage our guilt by doing this, but actually people don't actually ask the question, where does that recycled glass go? And the point is that it's a massive glut of it. We don't know what to do with it. And so we ship it off to China. Now, that's probably not a good thing, shipping it halfway around the world.
What happens to it when it gets to China?
Well, it gets recycled, and sometimes it comes back as other products, but mostly it doesn't. So all these questions, I mean, just this one wine bottle, you know, unravels quite a lot of the way that we live. And I just don't... At the moment, I think we're in early days of thinking about these questions. And so that's the point. The point is, it's not surprising we haven't solved them or come up with any sensible kind of solutions to them. And I suppose my glib comment about landfill was perhaps glib. And it doesn't mean that I'm not interested in these quite fundamental questions. But I just think to prioritise recycling over landfill is just too easy. It's just too easy, unless you're going to really think about this subject properly. And I don't think many people do. I'm not sort of accusing anyone. I'm just saying that we don't, as a society, think about it very deeply, and we haven't.
What would you imagine being a possibility for, as you were saying, that this relationship to sustainability of materials, or how we engage with matter now on the planet? How would you sort of suggest what would be in ways to pursue? And not non-cosmetically.
This is just I'm sort of romantic at heart, I suppose. But I think the fundamental thing is not to look at it as a system, as an industrial system of consumption and reuse and recycling, because that is to make us all into these kind of pieces of a capitalist system, which we just have to create a system that works and works for the planet. And And I just don't buy into that really at all. I think that your personal relationship with the materials and the stuff around you is the important thing. And that relationship has changed. And the system we now live in reflects that relationship. So if you want the system to change, you have to change your relationship with things like your mobile phone and with things like the cupboard that you're going to throw out instead of repairing. Or if you're going to go to a mass furniture production and buy some cheap thing, why didn't you go to someone who makes furniture and ask them if they come to your house and look at the space you're looking for and talk it through?
Because it's economics, isn't it, really? I mean, it's to do with how it's cheaper.
But the question is, does it, on a mass scale, people think that's going to make them happier by having more of these things. And then they have to pay higher taxes to have all this. The economic system is based on the consumption idea.
Mm.
But I'm saying that if we
change our relationship to consumption dramatically.
It's not so much consumption, because I'm not an economist. I'm not sure I would. But I just think that. I like people who repair things, for instance.
Mm, yeah.
And we've ended up in a system where no one repairs clothes
anymore. Well, it's very difficult
anymore.
To even. I had a washing machine, it broke. Like three times this guy said he could repair it, he couldn't repair it. He had to get another one.
Yeah, well, exactly. So people don't make washing machines to be repaired anymore, right? I mean,
the
whole system kind of. But that's because we don't demand it, right? I mean, if we demanded that, when you commission someone to make something that's. So in the lab, for instance, we buy big bits of kit that are very specific from companies, and they make them for us. And then when they go wrong, they have to come and repair them. You can't just buy another one; they're too expensive. And anyway, they've been made specially for us. The relationship with that piece of equipment and that technology becomes very personal. You love it, you know. You rely on it. There is a relationship there.
Mm.
And I would say that part of being human. There's something about looking after things, which isn't just about economics.
Yeah, well, there's also something about newness.
Yeah.
I think that now one of our sort of ideological hard wirings is this an obsession with new now.
Yeah.
You know, even the fact that it's impossible to commit to something for the fourth plinth, it has to change, and even now it's a changing every hour plinth. You know, this idea of things all being having to. Change and be new, surprise element of something new, and that's a kind, you know, that seems to be, as I say, ideological for us now.
Yeah.
Even the idea that you get trained to, you know, I mean, to check if there's a new email, to check what's come up on the website of the Guardian.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like we've all suddenly kind of become caught in some obsession about now. What's or the next thing or the new thing? So the idea of having things old and repairing them and is out. I mean, even you know, a friend of mine who was writing for the Times was told, "You're not allowed to refer to anything that's more than a year old." Another example: I'm making a film about Grace Jones. I've been filming her for 6 years.
Oh.
Really incredibly, incredible access. She's an extraordinary human being. I hear that the BBC are making films about icons. Surely this must, we must belong here. No. Grace Jones is not our kind of icon. It's like Britney Spears. It's more like now icons. You know, so it's this.
But I'm not sure. I mean, I suppose I think that the urge to renew yourself is, and to be new and to kind of, it's probably always been there, hasn't it? It's just that we now are so rich that we can really indulge. I mean, we can just stuff ourselves with it, can't we? I mean, it's a bit like that, isn't it? We've become so rich. We live like the kings and queens. You know, 200 years ago, a king and queen would have had about the same amount of luxury as we have. Everybody has, well, most people have in this country. So, what do you know? And yet, we worry about the global economy and that slipping behind. I mean, it's absurd in a way, isn't it? I mean, we should be worrying about our soul. I mean, we've got rich now.
You are romantic, aren't you?
Yeah. I suppose I am. Well, we are.
But even what our soul is even hugely up for debate if it even exists at all.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it'd be nice to have a bit of debate about that.
I mean, there are debates that happen, in theory circles, and I mean, because now there's some reemergence of religion, is also how nature and ecology function as a new kind of religion, creating prohibitions, creating guilt, creating kind of recycling what you feel if you haven't, that the way that it's so hard for us to really actually engage with materials directly without having this kind of phantasmatic layer in between everything.
I do have a solution, though. Well, not a solution, but it's just a kind of a proposal, which is this, that in the Victorian times, we decided that it was a really good thing if everyone read a bit more, because actually that was going to enrich society. It wasn't about getting rich. It was a bit about education, but it was quite an altruistic idea that everybody could be enriched culturally and by having access to books. So what happened? Every town, every village got a library. I mean, it was a massive what an amazing act that was. What an amazing kind of gift to society that was. And of course, the relics are still there, although they're sort of dying now, and they're kind of... And I think what every town and every village needs now is a workshop. Mm-hmm. I think that we are physical beings, and we've lost. Although we're consuming a lot, we don't actually make anything. And our hands are an important part of us. And it's actually really hard to make things unless you have the proper equipment. And it's really hard to unless you have a community of people who do it. So let's have local workshops, and then there are lots of people who would hang out in those workshops and create a different approach to materials.
I must say, as a woman, it's incredibly erotic when you know that a man can really make something. You know, it's like, wow, you know.
Yeah.
I think that that's a new task for metrosexual men.
so they can be dating clubs.
Set up workshops immediately.
Go to the workshop and meet women. Impress your women.
No, you have to know, you've got to go and learn how to make things and make things work. And, you know, also manage animals would be good.
Yeah, well, now you're really talking about eroticism.
It's a kind of utopia that maybe you should write a sort of manifesto towards a utopia.
No, but how does change happen? Change. I mean, we live in a world of huge change. We've just been talking about it, and you sort of one thinks that it's driven by something. Someone somewhere has got an agenda, which is they're pushing it forward. I mean, some sector of society is doing this. Well, perhaps, or perhaps not.
But this is the problem. This is the big misconception that somehow someone out there is determining our fate, and it's all being managed. But in fact, it's spontaneous. We're all participating spontaneously, and it's not being done to us. This change in our lives, it is a kind of a choice, and you do have to learn. I think it's that being able to see where these feelings are coming or where these power forces are active on you, and how to resist them requires a lot of thinking.
Yeah, and I agree with that.
And action. Then.
Yeah, I mean, we're part of a bigger and bigger organisation as well, aren't we? I mean, if you look at your life and you look at how many pieces of equipment you rely on, and I mean, but really rely on, what stops your life? Well, the washing machine breaking down. I mean, literally, you stay at home.
Well, that was what was amazing when they had the oil strike here, when they weren't delivering oil. Petrol, and suddenly it was really palpable how within a week the whole of the mechanics of the UK was at a standstill, pretty much. Food wasn't delivered, everything would stop without oil being constantly pumped in, and that dependency on oil was really talk about engaging with it as its impact on our lives and how they can work or can't.
Yeah. Or, on your kind of personal level, if your boiler breaks down any time from now till the middle of next April, it's a source of great, it sort of completely stops you in your tracks, right? You no longer become a real person anymore. If you haven't got a boiler, you haven't got hot water, you haven't got heating. Suddenly you kind of, and yet you want instant satisfaction for that. You want that to be fixed, I want to phone someone up and I want them to fix it. I'm going to pay for them to fix it. It's like, you just want to be a god. Fix it. You have no interest in working out how it works.
That's maybe a male thing. I always have a feeling of hopelessness that I can't fix it, of frustration that...
But we've done this to ourselves, haven't we? We could have made a whole set of boilers that the people who who live. It's a bit like gardening, right? I mean, you can make gardening into something that no one can do at home, that can only be done by the professionals. But that isn't what gardening is. Gardening is this wonderful kind of craft. We can do that to the rest of technology. It doesn't have to be this way. The question is how do you, and I feel like that would enrich us in ways that I have no idea. But I just have this urge. I mean, it's my own kind of urge to. Yeah. I mean, I try and mend things all the time, and I mostly fail. But the act kind of pleases me.
I agree with your inclination. I mean, I think everyone here probably would. But you know, it's the time factor. It's how everything is so speeded up. There's not the time to learn to get the manual to even learn how to garden. You know, it's hard to.
Yeah, because you have to do your stuff so that someone else can be the expert at mending the boiler. I mean, you know, you're the filmmaker. So you make the films. I'm the scientist. I do the science. Someone else does the boilers. And we've split our time.
Are there
up.
Other people doing your kind of? Is what's your scientific name description?
Materials science.
Science. Yeah. But you're not a materialist in that sense, in any sense.
I don't know. Really. It's actually funny, isn't it, that we do all this stuff in science departments, and we're completely isolated from. Economists, and we're completely isolated from historians, and we're completely—I mean, the university is a joke in that sense because there is no dialogue between those departments, almost none.
That's crazy, yeah.
It is absolutely a joke. I mean, it's hilariously funny. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, people come to do a degree and they do one subject. They go to a university and they spend all their time with one set of people, and they have—I mean, there was no reason to have the other subjects there. You might as well all be in different buildings. I mean, and I think that's also part of the problem. And I'm as guilty of it as anyone. It's hard to get out of these. How to get this straitjacket that we've built for ourselves somehow? Not that unhappy, but I feel like I've moaned for half an hour. I'm really sorry about that. I'm usually quite optimistic person.
That's probably the effect having on you.
I'm not accusing you at all.
And you're at which university? Is it King's?
King's College London.
King's College London. Yeah.
Although you know.
I never went to university. I have no experience. I left school at 16, so I feel completely like fascinated by how it works to be in an institution like a university, and how I was imagining that there is all this crossover and people are crossing courtyards and having conversations. And
if only it was that way. David Lodge books always very kind of comforting for me because they you know, it's like looking in a mirror and you kind of suddenly see how dysfunctional. Universities are, but I am.
Don't you do things like have football teams from each department where you all play matches? Or...
No, people are really ruthless.
You could start there with
people are very focused on. I mean, basically, my take on academia mostly is this: it's a place where you can really, really develop your ego. I mean, it is the one place where it's absolutely fine to be completely blatant about that. That is the point of the place, and. People do it very well. Well, actually, is it? I mean, in a sense, that can really push society forward. I mean, if you really you want brilliant ideas, you need brilliant people, and you need people who are very confident. And I'm not opposed to that at all. And I don't think universities should be like real life. I do think they should be these strange other places. And they are like that. They are they're very alien. But they're not somewhere you can feel comfort. And I don't feel like they. What I feel about them, but they're great for people who are developing their ego, and in that sense they're good society, but they're not, I don't think they do students a service. I mean, the people who come in a sense, you would have thought they would be orientated towards that body, but they, weirdly enough, are not. So you didn't miss out, is what I'm saying. They're good if you want to develop your ego, but if you don't want to develop, if you want actually just have an education, they're very good for getting drunk, actually. They're brilliant bars and for meeting people. People tend to, yeah. And that's what most people use them for, actually.
I always hear that.
Yes.
It's sad about the students. I mean, how galvanized do students get coming in now? How, other than being drunk?
It's sad. It saddens me that there isn't more activism. That actually, that people are very focused on getting a job. The university
that's definitely
seems
true now. Yeah. It's all about career kind of. Not really about expanding your thinking, but about having this panic of, you know, you meet like 20-year-olds who go, by the time I'm 22, I could afford a flat, you know, I can do this, you know, and it's like, whoa.
But they come they come out with £30,000 of debt now, you know, so it's not a joke getting a job, and they are in huge debt.
It's really terrible,
actually. It's not as if I blame them for that. They are part of a system now which we've created, which is, again, you know, sort of.
By the balls before you've even left.
Well, it inculcates you into this idea that you've got to play the game, right? If university is going to be to develop free thinkers and people who don't play the game, well, it can't do that in that system, right? It's problematic.
Yeah.
But and this is what frustrates me about politics, because no one talks about these things. I mean, there's no one who says these things. There appears to be no representation of those ideas. All the main parties seem to talk from the main boom sheet. Anyway. Thank you very much.